You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 9th of December, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, yesterday I was unable to bring you a Daily Traditionalist. I'm having some internet problems at the moment, hoping to get them sorted out by Thursday, tomorrow, for Dr. Johnson's podcast. I can upload at the moment, but I can't really download, and I'm having difficulties opening pages up. So it's a bit difficult for me to find news articles to cover today. And there really isn't that much going on in the news today. We've got a black footballer who stormed off the pitch because the referee referred to him as a black footballer. That's the level that we have descended to now. When you actually identify somebody as what they are, they assume that that must be racism. So what we will do today is I have something here that I was intending for Truth Will Out Radio, because it's more to do with that sort of a subject. A lot of people have been asking for us to interview Thomas Dalton. Thomas Dalton is an author. He's authored quite a few books. He writes for the Occidental Observer. A couple of his more famous books are Debating the Holocaust. There's another one on the Nuremberg Transcripts. But the thing that he's most well known for is the definitive English translation of Mein Kampf. And some listeners out there may not be aware, but there are a lot of criticisms of the English translations. The wording isn't carried out that well. There aren't any headings in the translation. So he has created an up-to-date modern translation of Mein Kampf, which I have yet to read, but the people that have read it tell me that it is excellent, very, very good. And quite a few of them have been requesting that I would get him on the show to interview him. So I wrote to Dr. Dalton and asked him if he would come on the show. And he doesn't do audio or video interviews for obvious reasons, I guess, really. But he said he was quite happy to answer questions if we sent him a few questions. So I spoke to the people that were asking for me to get him on the show, and they sent some questions in, and I added a few bits to these questions. So what we will do today is we will go through his answers, and I'll just give a bit of background to him first. You can find him at thomasdaltonphd.com. And Thomas Dalton is a professor of humanities at a major American university. And of course, that explains why he doesn't do audio or video interviews. He has published several books and articles on history and religion, with a special focus on the National Socialist era in Germany. He has also conducted extensive research on historical and contemporary Jewish relations, and also evolutionary psychology, obviously applying evolutionary psychology to the Jews, which is what we are looking at the moment in the Truth Will Out program on Friday. So anybody who is interested in that, do check out Friday's Truth Will Out Radio. Now, the first question I asked him is, what started you off on the path to historical revisionism and the role of Jews in society? Were you interested in National Socialism first or the Holocaust narrative? He says, I've been interested in World War II and Hitler's Germany for as long as I can remember. One of my first major papers that I wrote in high school was on Hitler, and I used to get Hitler books for my birthday. Thank God my parents didn't censor me. As a teen, I built model rockets, and my prized possession was a model of the German V2. It sits in my study to this day. A personal highlight for me was seeing an actual V2 in the Munich Museum of Science and Technology. It was fantastic. I also was curious about Jews as a youth, but that quickly ran me into trouble. I specifically recall writing a paper in school on Einstein and being sternly rebuked by my teacher because I said he was a Jew. "That doesn't matter," she said. "Yeah, right." That really stunned me. I told the truth about a Jew and got attacked for it. That was my first lesson on the Jewish question. But I had no personal dealings with Jews until college. My university was known for drawing large numbers of Jewish students from out of state, especially from New York. But at first, I knew nothing of this. While in the student housing, the dormitory, I particularly recall the loud and obnoxious guys from New York. For a long time, I just assumed that everyone from New York was loud, rude, and annoying. It wasn't until my final year that I realized that they were Jews from New York, and it was quite an eye-opener. So it wasn't New Yorkers who were the problem. It was the Jewish New Yorkers. Okay, another good lesson there. And I'll just pause there, because I have had a similar experience. I used to be very, very anti-American right the way from childhood. I can remember being anti-American. I didn't like the way they were on the television. I didn't like the way they were so loud and so brash. I didn't appreciate their sense of humor. And I can recall at the time wondering where all these strange names came from, that they weren't English names, and yet these were Americans and wasn't America settled by the English? And it wasn't until quite a few decades later that I realized, in actual fact, what I found offensive were the Jews on the television and the Jewish comedies. And it was that was giving me a false portrayal of what America was like. And when I became a nationalist and started interacting with Americans who weren't Jewish Americans, I realized that they have much the same attitudes as myself, the same sense of humor as myself, same dry sense of humor and appreciation for sarcasm and irony and all these sort of things that you don't see in Jewish comedy. Genuine white comedic sense of humor. So I can appreciate exactly what Dr. Dalton is saying here, and I noticed that myself, and obviously I have a far greater appreciation for Americans now, but years ago, I used to blame America for all the problems in the world, and it was because I didn't realize that these people that I was actually taking offense at, they weren't the genuine Americans, or at least they weren't white Americans. Of course, I thought they were white Americans. I didn't realize that they were Jews and that Jews do not identify as white. Continuing with the interview here, Dr. Dalton says, "Also, at that time, I became more attuned to racial and genetic issues. I read about Rushden's theory about blacks and lower intelligence as having a genetic basis, and that struck me as entirely correct. But the data were surprising. Based on IQ tests, only about 1/6 of blacks are even above the white average of 100. 5/6 of blacks are sub-average. This explains a lot. And then when you add in all the other social and psychological consequences of black genetics, you see why we have race problems." And I'll just stop there to comment on J.P. Rushden and recommend to listeners that they get a copy of his book, Race, Evolution and Intelligence. It's only about 70 pages long, I think, the version that you can find online, but it is absolutely packed with all the information you need to know about the differences between the races. It's nothing hateful, it's just pointing out the differences between the races. And of course, as a nationalist, we believe that social policy should be based upon the reality of race, not based upon ideas of how we would wish reality to be, as if we were all equal, because we are not all equal. And J.P. Rushden's book showed that, and he traveled around the world, mainly doing IQ tests, particularly in Africa. He was doing IQ tests in the universities of Africa to find out if the brightest people in the universities also had a lower average IQ, which of course he found that they did. And I believe Edward Dutton has written a biography of J.P. Rushton that's supposed to be very good as well. And also, Ed Dutton has just produced a new book on race that listeners might be interested in having a look at, purchasing for Christmas. Getting back to the interview here. On the Holocaust, I never gave it much thought. Even through college, I more or less accepted the traditional story, even as I had some nagging questions about it. For example, how exactly those gas chambers worked. I just assumed that there were dozens of gassing camps all over Germany. It wasn't until my late 30s, I would say, that I started reading a bit more. I was surprised to find out that there were only 6 gassing camps and that they were all in Poland and none in Germany. Then I tracked down a copy of Butz's book, Hoax of the 20th Century. It was dense and hard to read, but I got enough out of it to realise that something was up with the usual story. A year or two later, I was hunting around on the internet and came across Germar Rudolph's book, Dissecting the Holocaust, and that really opened my eyes to all the problems. I then bought some of the books by Mattonio and Graf, and then I had the full picture in front of me. All the while, I was becoming increasingly aware of the influence of the Jewish lobby, of David Duke's views and harassments, and of Israeli crimes in Palestine. By the early 2000s, I knew I could make a contribution and started writing my first book, Debating the Holocaust, which came out in 2009. Now we are up to a 4th revised and expanded edition, and it is today one of the best-selling revisionist books. And I just found out that an Italian publisher wants to do an Italian translation, which is great news. And again, I will just stop there and say to listeners, if you want to get a copy of Dissecting the Holocaust, then go to thomasdaltonphd.com. Now, I first came across Holocaust revisionism on the internet through YouTube, through watching the videos Buchenwald, A Dumb, Dumb Portrayal of Evil, and One Third of the Holocaust. There used to be a website called Holocaust Denial Videos, and you could find all these videos on there. They also used to be all on YouTube as well. And I can remember watching that and thinking, why didn't I ask these questions before when I was hearing about this? And I can recall seeing on the news the Holocaust trial, the great Holocaust trial that went on in Canada of Ernst Zundel. And thinking at the time, well, these people, they can't be idiots. They're being taken to court here. They obviously believe that what they say is right. There must be some evidence for it. What is the evidence that is being covered up here? What is it that these people know that we don't? Because on the face of it, it would appear that there is so much evidence for the Holocaust. I can remember thinking at the time, but what about the dead bodies? What about all these bodies that we have seen? What about the eyewitnesses? So the fact that we weren't actually being told what the other side was saying made me suspicious. But it wasn't until years later, as I say, that I actually came across the revisionist historical view, and obviously I believe the revisionist historical view is the correct one, particularly when you look at the scientific side of what we're being told happened in the Holocaust. Getting back to the interview here, I next asked Dr. Dalton, why do you feel there was a need for another English translation of Mein Kampf? Are there any parts in particular that had a confused meaning in the older translations? And he replied, like most people, I was only vaguely aware of Mein Kampf for many years. I knew of it, but never tracked down a copy. And no one else seemed to quote from it. It was the most invisible, famous book ever. In the early 2000s, I flipped through a copy in a bookstore and found it terrible, hard to read, no logical flow of ideas, poorly written. Only much later did I realise that this was by design. And I'll just stop there. I bought a copy of Mein Kampf from Amazon. I think it was actually reduced to £1. It was a paperback version. I don't think it had that many notes that were added to it. And I can remember reading it and thinking, well, this is nothing like I had been told Mein Kampf was going to be. It's not talking about gassing Jews, and it's mainly historical, and it's actually giving me a broader understanding of the politics around the time of the First World War and what actually happened to Germany. And it's giving me an idea of how it seemed to the Germans. And again, it's something that we are not taught, is what it was like from the other side in the war, how the defeated peoples saw what happened in the war. And that's what really struck me the first time that I read Mein Kampf. Getting back to the interview here, once I had published my first Holocaust book, I turned again to Mein Kampf. I found out that there were two main English translations by Ralph Mannheim, a German Jew, and James Murphy. Both were done in the 1940s, both were very British, and both, frankly, were poorly done. Murphy's was better and more sympathetic, but that's not saying much. Mannheim's became the official version and remains so today, despite its nearly unreadable style. The version you buy in a bookstore today, published by Houghton Mifflin, has a horrible introduction by the Zionist Jew Abe Foxman. So that tells you a lot. Again, I'll just stop there. There is a version in Germany, because it was banned in Germany, and it's now been released in Germany. And I believe the annotations, the footnotes, actually make up more space than the actual wording of Mein Kampf. So all these contradictions that have been put in there to try to contradict what Adolf Hitler actually said take up more space than the wording of the book itself. By 2015, I was determined to do a better version. So I tracked down copies of the Mannheim and Murphy translations, along with a couple of other obscure translations. I then got a copy of the German original and basically went line by line comparing the translations to the original. And I then created a better, smoother, and more readable English text. In the process, I did other things. I added in-text section headings from Hitler's originals, which helped to break up the long chapters. I added many footnotes to elaborate or explain things that Hitler mentioned. He was remarkably well-read, by the way, and referred to many things in history, culture, and politics that I was unaware of. I wrote a sympathetic introduction, and I added a bibliography and index. I also decided to publish two versions, a standard English translation and then a dual German-English edition, with the two texts running in parallel, German on the left and English on the right, so that anyone could, in theory, confirm my translation. Finally, since the original is very long, two volumes, I wanted to do a concise best-of edition that would capture the most interesting sections. This was eventually published as The Essential Mein Kampf. So today there are actually five books available: a standard English translation in two volumes, a dual German-English version in two volumes, and a one-volume Essential Mein Kampf. All need updating, and I will be doing that in the coming year. Also, I want to produce hard cover versions of each book for the real connoisseurs, so look out for that in the near future. The other trick, of course, is making people aware of these new versions. Amazon quickly banned all my editions of Mein Kampf, along with all my Holocaust books, so I have to rely on other secondary booksellers. All my books are listed on my personal webpage, www.thomasdaltonphd.com, along with links to sellers that carry my books. Also, I am working on a new webpage for my publishing arm, Clemens and Blair, so hopefully that will help sales as well. And I do recommend people read Mein Kampf, as I say, just to get a better view of history and a better understanding of what Hitler was all about. We have this cartoon caricature of this crazy evil guy that was shouting a lot, and we're told that the Germans just went crazy and they all followed him because he sort of mesmerized them with his hypnotic speeches. And that's the approved view that people are supposed to have. But if you actually read Mein Kampf, you get an understanding of what was driving the guy. And he wasn't an evil man. He was trying to do his best for his people. He worked his way up from being very poor, being homeless at one time, being imprisoned, and making his way to leading a first world country. It's really a tale of what you can do with hard work and diligence. And of course, because he had seen what life was like at the bottom of the heap, he had a lot of ideas of how it could be improved if you actually had power. And there's nothing in there about exterminating Jews or anything like that. There's nothing in there about replacing Christianity with some pagan religion. There's nothing in there about wanting to conquer the world. It's if you want to have a rounded view of history and understand what went on in the 20th century, truly went on in the 20th century, then it's a book that everybody should read. And I do believe it is, it's a best-selling book. It really is a best-selling book in all countries. It's one of the most best-selling books that there has ever been. Number three, I asked Dr. Dalton, as someone who works in academia, are there others who can see the dangers in the new cancel culture but are too scared for their careers to speak out? How far in advance of general society has it got in universities? Are there any particular instances of political correctness that we would be surprised at that you can tell us about whilst maintaining your anonymity? And he replied as follows. Academia has really declined in recent years. It was always quite politically correct and overly liberal, but for many years there was a tolerance of dissenting ideas. But things really began to change after 9/11, and everyone got sensitive to anything sounding vaguely terroristic. Also, as the boycott, divestment and sanction movement against Israel, the BDS movement, ramped up on campuses, the academic Jews got more proactive in stifling anything that they didn't like. I supported many BDS actions on my campus and got a lot of negative publicity for it. No doubt it hampered my career, but for me, speaking out and doing the right thing was more important. But in the process, I could really see how the Jewish faculty worked with the Jewish administrators and the Jewish regents and trustees, along with the Jewish donors, to create an oppressive climate. Even the simplest steps towards BDS, for example, got very little open support among faculty, even ones who were tenured, and even ones who studied the situation in the Middle East and knew better. Privately, they might back you up, but when it came to signing something or speaking up in a meeting, forget it. I mean, what we see here is Jewish networking. Of course, Jews are going to work to further their own interests. That is only natural. The problem that we have is with us as white people, we don't do the same thing. We don't do what is best for our own interests. We've been conned into thinking what we should be doing is what's best for everybody else. So it's not that Jews should be prevented from doing this. It's that we should be encouraged to do the same thing. He says, thus it became one of my themes to discuss in class, as appropriate, Jewish influence in politics, economics, media, and finance. For the students, this was highly enlightening, to say the least. Things got noticeably worse after Trump won in 2016. Many of the liberals, especially the hyper-feminists, snapped. They went nuts. They were drafting statements and open letters, establishing safe spaces, and generally pushing new ultra-liberal, anti-racist, pro-feminist BS at an alarming pace. New faculty hires had to be ultra-liberal, preferably women of colour, or Jewesses. No white males need apply, nor could any hope for promotional opportunities, recognition, resources, and so on. And obviously, this is probably going on in all universities from what we can see in the media, what is being reported on in the universities, and the silencing of all dissenting voices. It's not just unique to the university that Dr. Dalton is at. And of course, it works its way from the universities into the rest of society. And I've noticed the massive change since Donald Trump won the election. It's like they're no longer trying to hide what they're doing. they're quite open about what they're doing. And with the help of the mainstream media, it promotes the idea that there is no resistance to this whatsoever. But of course, if you talk to just normal members of public, they're all alarmed at what is going on. The mainstream media is manufacturing opinion rather than reporting on it, which is, of course, why it's so important that we have a healthy alternative media to report on the other side of it, which is, of course, what we do here at Radio Albion. Dr. Dalton continues, "Of course, the new hires, if they are of the right stripe, can use this situation to their advantage. In one department that I was aware of, a rare tenure track opening occurred, and the usual list of mostly women and minorities got whittled down to a bright Jewess from New York who took the job. They got her to teach some ridiculous course on race and feminism, which drew about 5 students, I believe. But then we found out she really had no intention of staying at our mere mid-grade campus. And so, as soon as she arrived, she immediately began applying to upscale Eastern universities. Within 6 months, she got her promotion and left. So our 18-month, multi-thousand-dollar search effort went to naught. But the Jewess did well for herself. We will see what happens now that Biden has won. In many ways, I suspect it will get worse. The ultra-liberals feel like they won, and now they will push even harder for political correctness in all phases of academia." And of course, I still hold out hope that Donald Trump is going to manage to prove his case that there was electoral fraud. And in actual fact, if he doesn't manage to prove his case that there was electoral fraud, then it has been put forward by various lawyers that what he needs to do is institute martial law. And if he did institute martial law, then he would need to arrest all the ringleaders of this fraud. And we might well see a change in the universities to prevent this silencing of all opposing ideas, because this is where it comes from. All these ultra-liberals, the ones, the journalists, the politicians, the oligarchs, all of them were educated at these universities where they had these anti-white ideas drummed into them. If we want to get to the root of the problem, then we have to look at what is happening in the universities. And our best hope for something like that happening is for Donald Trump to get a second term after this election fraud and the way the journalists have treated him. He really cannot help but realize the criminal element in this. And I believe he would do all he can to try to right the wrongs that have been carried out against him and against the American people and against whites. And I would hope he would try to put them right in the final 4 years that he gets. So I am always optimistic. The glass is always half full for me rather than half empty. So I am still hoping that we will see Trump get a second term next year. But we will have to wait and see. That finishes the interview with Dr. Dalton. He did say that he would be open to answering more questions if anybody sends any in. And just a reminder that you can find his books and some of his other articles at thomasdaltonphd.com. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow, hopefully, with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.